We've been talking quite a bit about meditation, and thank you, Ken, for talking to us about some of your own meditation experiences and your experiences with various teachers. And a question that is often asked is, do you need a teacher in order to meditate, in order to learn to meditate, in order to progress with meditation?
Yes, no, both, neither, inexpressible. That's right, it's an inexpressible. I'm going to claim inexpressible for all of the hard questions from now on, and then I can give an aura of profundity, you see, when I really don't know what I'm talking about.
But what do the traditions say, Ken?
Well, it's if you want to learn French or you want to learn algebra, do you need a teacher? Yes and no. I mean, it's just a really good teacher makes anything easier. But there's a kind of a central hidden issue in whether you need a teacher in spiritual development. And it has to do with the whole process of what's called transmission. And if transmission is the key to spiritual growth, and
that's
I'll explain that
if,
in a second.
But that's a big if. We're going to have to get
that's
back
correct.
To that.
That's correct. I'm saying if. If it is, then obviously you need a transmitter, and that would be the teacher. On the other hand, if spiritual practice is more a matter of technique, then you can learn a technique. It's not dependent upon a person, although a person might help, but then it's more a facilitator or a friend or an instructor and not a guru or a master or teacher with a capital T. I think there's no question but that transmission exists and that it occurs. We were saying earlier that basically we're all always transmitting our states. And there's an energetic component to that. We have gross, subtle, and causal energies, which we briefly talked about. And whenever you're sort of plugged into any of those or vibrating, you're actually sort of sending out those kinds of energetic waves. I believe you can actually measure those. We have a fair amount of evidence for that, at least in terms of some of the gross and subtle energies. And so we sort of say we're on the same wavelength, we're tuning into somebody, and it's almost literal. I mean, we really can tune into those kinds of energies. If somebody is really plugged into causal and non-dual states as either a plateau experience or just a very, very strong presence, there's a kind of very subtle energetic transmission that seems to go with that. Under those circumstances, satsang, which means in the presence of the enlightened one, being in the presence of somebody who is transmitting, is obviously something that's going to help quicken your own realization because it's going to resonate with these subtler and more profound energies in your own being and help bring them forth. So on the other hand, even though that might in a sense quicken your own process and be a great help in furthering your own growth and development, I don't think it's necessary, although I think obviously having an instructor and a technique makes it easier. But the issue really comes down when people talk about, do you need a guru? It's a whole tricky area about putting somebody up on a pedestal, having hierarchical relationships, ranking people, and that's a very, very difficult, delicate issue in our society. The bottom line for me is, yes, I really think a teacher helps, but it's not categorically necessary.
So talking more about transmission, you know, I've sat with lots of different spiritual teachers, and I definitely know what you're saying in terms of experiencing a shift in vibration or frequency, but I might liken that to an altered state or to a drug experience where when you're around them, you have the benefit of being in this elevated condition, but then when you're not, you just go back to wherever you were, and that real transformation isn't necessarily happening just by sitting in the presence of high beings.
I think that's an excellent point, and I think that's exactly right. It comes back again to the two really crucial components in an integral model. And that's states and stages. And what we're talking about with transmission is a type of state. It's an energetic state, or it can be a state of consciousness or awareness that's also transmitted energetically, a state of non-dual awareness, of presence, of clarity, of compassion, luminosity, and so on. But like any other altered state, it's temporary. In this case, when you're in the presence of the teacher, then you're getting this temporary state. If you're in the presence of a drug, you're getting the temporary state, and so on. States become useful, ultimately, only if they help your stage, your permanent growth and development. And theoretically, of course, what we're postulating, what we have some evidence for, and what the integral model suggests, is that the more you're plunged into these states with an attitude that you can learn from them, then the faster it accelerates your growth through the stages. So under those circumstances, again, it's not saying that a teacher is absolutely necessary, but it can be very helpful to be in the presence of somebody who is, in a sense, transmitting some of these states. But still, the hard work is converting those states into traits, and that means permanent stages or permanent competences, and that means you generally have to take up a spiritual practice. And it's the same if you're playing a piano, you have to practice piano. If you're weightlifting, you have to practice weightlifting. If you're learning French, you have to practice French. And if you're learning love, if you're learning to stay open as love under all conditions, if you're learning equanimity, if you're learning how to be aware under all conditions, those are practices, and you have to practice, and nothing is going to substitute for that. And any practice takes 4 or 5 years just to get a good solid foundation, whether it's learning to play the guitar or learning to meditate.
Many of these non-dual teachers who hold satsangs say that you don't actually have to meditate, in the sense that by committing to a practice like meditation, you're putting your enlightenment into the future, that, you know, we should call off the search, quote unquote. And it's that searching mechanism inside that keeps us running towards something in the future.
Oh, that's
correct. Focus on being present. So that meditation itself perpetuates
exactly.
This idea of the search.
That's true. It's true, but it's only half the story. We were talking a little bit earlier about when Nagarjuna and all the wisdom traditions make a distinction between absolute truth and relative truth. And absolutely, it's true that meditation is absolutely irrelevant, that if you really get caught in the game of meditating in order to find non-dual spirit, you will perpetually miss the point. If non-dual ever-present awareness is, in fact, ever-present, then trying to seek something that's ever-present would be like spending years looking for your feet. I mean, it's just a ridiculous concept in those circumstances. So if people who are transmitting a non-dual state are attempting to convey is that there's some part of your awareness right now that is 100% enlightened. And we can talk about that in a minute, but it literally is the case. 100% of the enlightened mind is present right now. And ultimate absolute spirituality, in a sense, consists of being able to recognize that ever-present state. And that doesn't take, and indeed cannot take, stages, steps in time, because anything that you do in time is beside the point. Any state that has a beginning in time is not the absolute state. So there's something that's ever present, something that you have known your entire life, as a matter of fact, something you've known for a billion years, as a matter of fact, something you've known for 15 billion years since the Big Bang and before. And that's this ever present noticing witness that we can talk about a little bit more in a moment. When you're going to non-dual teachers, they are attempting to point that out to you in a way that you can recognize your own original face, recognize this ever-present isness that is your own absolute ultimate condition. Krishnamurti would do the same thing. The Vedantins and Neo-Vedantins do the same thing. And as I say, in terms of absolute truth, they're absolutely right. But then there's also the relative world, and that's what actually happens when you do that. All the little things in the relative, finite, manifest world that are necessary for you to come into circumstances where you can recognize your condition. And realistically speaking, those include a lot of things. They include, if nothing else, reading a book of Krishnamurti. They include going to these teachers. They include sitting and listening to them tell you that you shouldn't be trying to do anything. All of those are things that prepare the ground for you to have this realization of your already free, ever-present self. That still, even if you have that recognition, even if you're ensconced in one taste in a perfectly profound way, we still have evidence that you can give individuals these tests of development in various developmental lines, and some people score at level 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or so on. In other words, in the relative plane, where you're manifesting in your own personality, whether you're Ken Wilber or John Doe or Jane Doe or anybody like that, there's the relative vehicle itself and how it manifests and contains this non-dual awareness. And if you're at moral stage 3 and you have this recognition, you're still going to be at moral stage 3. You have to work through those aspects in the relative vehicle in order to contain and effectively transmit that recognition of one taste or non-duality. So an integral approach, in a sense, attempts to acknowledge and honor that ever-present oneness, because that is the foundation. It's the goal, in a sense, but it's also the ground. It's the ever-present ground, and you want to acknowledge that. There's also a path to being able to recognize that ground in the first place and hold that recognition. And if you actually talk with some of the teachers who are teaching that, and you actually trace their own path, you'll see a whole series of things that they did. And it's actually necessary for them to do in order to get to the place where they could say, you don't have to do anything. And so you have to be a little bit careful about that.
I mean, it seems to me it's actually dangerous when they say you don't have to do anything.
Well, you see, if it's part of a teaching on the whole, and what they're doing is saying, look, what I'm going to do right now is try to point out that part of you that's ever present, then that's fine, because that part of you that's ever present is not seeking. That part of you that's ever present is aware of seeking. Okay? So if you're going to sit down and say, I want to have an experience, then you're missing it on at least two or three different counts. One, if you want to see it as an object, this great experience you're going to have, well, then you're not the seer, are you? You're not the witness. You're looking for objects out there that you can experience and touch. Wrong. You can't. It's not an object. Anything you can see is not the seer. If you're looking for it in time, then you're looking for a string of experiences that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So you're trying to bring it into existence in time. The timeless does not exist in that stream. It is the ever-present nowness. So if you're searching for it as an object, or you're searching for it in time, or you're searching for it as an experience, those are all wrong. Categorically wrong. And as long as you're doing that, you're simply not going to recognize what is. So if they're trying to give you those pointing out instructions and tell you that any seeking, any search, any movement is beside the point and categorically off the mark, that's fine. But if they just sort of leave you hanging there, it usually doesn't take. Most people don't get that recognition the first time it's pointed out to them. And therefore, realistically, you have to have a whole series of things in place. If nothing else, the teacher will say, well, okay, listen to the talk where I said that once a day. So that they actually have to kind of sneak in some sort of temporal practice in order for you to recognize that you don't have to practice. If they do that, that's fine. But so many of them are so understandably exalted by this non-dual state that they're not very strong on what you have to do in the relative plane in order to make that state stick in your case, or even help you recognize it in your own case. And so again, a little bit more of an integral approach tends to help. And then also we're at the point right now where we're increasingly able to do some of the types of research we were talking about, where you can take people that have had this realization, but also test them on the other developmental lines, see where they are in terms of moral development, cognitive development, interpersonal development, and so on. We don't know right now how all of that's going to fall out. But it does appear that people can have this one-taste, non-dual experience at virtually any stage, and it doesn't necessarily make them change stages. You know, our theory is that it accelerates it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're as high in terms of development as you can be. And many of the teachers teaching this non-dual state are really not very high in certain areas of development. They're really quite poorly interpersonally developed sometimes, for example. So you have to be careful if they're not really giving you a means to recognize that means are not necessary, because otherwise you get in trouble.